This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And on the November 6th general election ballot, there are two general public questions to take a look at. And they pertain primarily to residents and voters in Calumet Township here in Lake County. They're both dealing with the Lake Ridge New Tech Schools. We're talking with Superintendent Dr. Sharon Johnson-Shirley. And thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, for folks that are not familiar with the Lake Ridge New Tech Schools, take a few minutes and tell us about the school district, and then we can go into the overall question, which I guess has basically affected all Lake County school districts, which is, of course, the changes that have been made back in 2010 that have led school districts to have to make some decisions to seek tax request increases.
Just a little bit about Lake Ridge New Tech Schools. We are a public school, and we are in the township of Gary, Indiana. We have two elementary schools, Longfellow New Tech Elementary, Hosford Park New Tech Elementary, one middle school, Lake Ridge New Tech Middle School, and our high school, Calumet New Tech High School. That's our school district. We have about 1,814 students this year, and that's enrollment is down. And you know that for every student, that's how we kind of run our schools based on our enrollment. And with it being down, we're losing money there as well. And so with our district, we are a high poverty district, but we never let poverty be a reason to educate our children. We are making sure that they have a high quality education by any means necessary.
I know that the Lake Ridge New Tech Schools has prided itself and has gotten a lot of good attention because of the fact that they have taken the opportunities to rework the school district from the traditional schools to look into the New Tech designation. Has what you have been able to do over the recent years been able to help the students as much as possible?
That's a good point. We are a New Tech School District, and that means we're project-based, problem-solving school district that works with the community. We seek partnerships. We work with the businesses. We're trying to make sure that our students are ready for college and careers. And for those that are not going to college, we want to make sure that they have an opportunity to be able to provide for their families with decent incomes. And so with this kind of model, because it is a model, and we've done it with fidelity for over 13 years, our students come back and testify, Dr. Shirley, you were on the right track. Mm-hmm. We were ready and prepared for college. We could collaborate, communicate, do presentations, talk with the best, and that's what we want.
Let's go back to 2010, and this is a problem that has cropped up with many school districts here in Lake County that have had to make changes and had, as we know, have gone to their patrons, to the voters in their particular school district, asking for assistance. In 2010, there's some major changes that the General Assembly put into place. Let's start there, if we may, and kind of walk us through what has happened in the Lake Ridge New Tech schools from that point on, I guess to the point of the election coming up here in November.
When funding started drying up, a lot of the money was placed into a voucher program. A lot of charter schools popped up all over our area, and that money was subtracted from our school districts. At that time, I think we lost something like $283 million in revenue that went back into surplus at the state level. Also, I know back then they reduced about $91 million of charter school debt, and that money was part of the public school's money. We decreased property tax, then state funding. Just going back to that, it caused us to continuously have to look at our finances. Let me just say this, mm-hmm. and I want to be clear about this because our community needs to know. It is nothing that we have done as a school district that is putting us in this dilemma. We have been very frugal. We've trimmed our budget. We've done everything to make sure that we are complying to budget in the black, and we've done that. But we're coming to a point where there's just not any more money, and we're running into a brick wall. All public schools, not just Lake Ridge School, we've lost over $50 million. And I know our legislators are sitting on something like billions of dollars in surplus, and all of our schools, our surrounding schools, are having to go out for referenda. Something is wrong with that, to me.
We noticed, for example, Lake Central's done that. Most recently, school city of Hammond and the school city of Munster have had to do the same. Those are some of the recent referenda here. And of course, on the ballot this year is Lake Ridge New Tech Schools. You talk about the changes and the cuts that you've had to make. I know that up to this point here, I understand it's been about $3 million or pretty close to that you made. And unfortunately, that's also not only making changes in staff and how things are handled at the individual schools, but had to make a decision to actually close an elementary school, did you not?
Absolutely, which has caused one of my schools overcrowding with students and just trying to find room to do what we need to do. It's just unfair. And on top of that, what my community needs to know, our school district is very old. Our buildings are old and dilapidated. We have pipes that are just filled to the brim with debris. We have a roof, and we have a HVAC problem all through the district. Let me just say, we have patched and tried to repair and, duct tape, all the things that we can possibly do. It is time for us to be able to give our building one makeover so that our students can have the opportunity to learn. Let me just ask the community. These parents know, the students go home and they tell them, we were hot today. It's very hot. The air conditioners didn't work, or the heat system didn't work, and they're sitting in classrooms with coats on. It is time to take care of that. Let me just say, as a superintendent, my heart hurts when I travel and go to other school districts that all students have to do is go to school. They don't have to worry about all of the issues going on in the building. They do not have to worry about the electricity not working and the computers going down. All of those things are taken care of. But in my district, you know, we may come in, the phones are down, the computers are down. That's maybe 2 hours out of our schedule for the day. Every time we have to stop and try to repair something, that's taken away from my students learning or being able to participate in the next level of their education.
Dr. Johnson Shirley, let's take a minute or two and talk a little bit about how this the two questions, I guess if you want to put it that way, the referendum is going to be set out so that voters will take a look at if they're in the Lake Ridge New Tech School District when they go into their polling place on November 6th and they open up the electronic voting machine and take a look at the pages. We note that there are two questions here. Let's go through, if we will, first the first question in more detail, and then you've kind of alluded to many of the things that we're asking for funding to help be able to accomplish in the second question. Let's go first through the first public question and talk more about that.
Let me kind of put them together, operational referendum and the capital referendum. The capital referendum is to raise funds for capital projects, such as construction projects and major overhauls of our facilities. We need to repair and renovate decade-old buildings. Our operational referendum is to raise funds to support the operation of school districts. For example, our salaries, our teacher salaries, simple things as busing, technology upkeep, and upgrades. And if you know anything about Lake Ridge schools, you know that we are sitting in an area where we do not have sidewalks. Our kids cannot walk to school and shouldn't have to walk to school. They deserve to ride a bus into the schools, and high priority for us is safety. Putting my kids on the bus in the morning kind of guarantees that they get to school safe unless there's something with an accident or something like that. But for the most part, I know they're going to get to and from school safely. And when we talk about the operational referendum, our teachers, you know, what really upsets me, and I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but what really upsets me, why is it that people don't understand this is a profession? Education is a profession. We all have had to go to college. We have had to do continuous learning. We also have had to keep going back to school to stay abreast of all the changes that's happening at the legislative level. We're doing a lot. And people, everybody, including you, had to go through a teacher, had to go through an educator. What is it that people don't understand about our profession? And we deserve to be paid for what we do. Of course we love children. Of course we care about the community. But we also support our families. We support our the staff needs to support their families. It is just not fair how education, and I'm not just talking at the local level, all the way to the national level. When we have somebody that comes to our school districts in Northwest Indiana, not stop at a public school, something's wrong with that. And I'm upset because this is like 30-something, I won't tell you all of the years that I've been in education, and I've watched all the changes. But to the point that I have to beg somebody to help me educate children, something's wrong with that. I'm very upset about it.
You had an opportunity earlier this year to present all of these issues to patrons in the Lake Ridge School District. What response, what reaction have you got, and what comments have you gotten back from the presentation to explain to them the importance of supporting the referendum, both questions, both the operational and the physical improvements that need to be made to the school district?
Let me just tell you, the worst part of it is people getting misinformation through Facebook. Social media is not our friend. And if they don't have the real answers, they create the answers. Mm-hmm. We've had several community meetings. We have school board meetings. We are going into the schools. We're getting ready to do some community forums. We're going to do knocking on doors to get the information out. People are not getting the information, and when they get it, it's not correct. The first thing I need is people to visit our website, get the facts as we have laid it out there for them to know. We're in this together. We're not the enemy. It's not the schools against the community. It is about us making it better for the community as well as their children. If we don't have good schools, there goes the community.
One of the things I note that I like here in the information that you have out is that you not only, of course, talk about the very important role that the schools play for children and for parents as well, but you also talk, too, about the school district being an economic development anchor. And that's one of the interesting things I find in that was mentioned in the PowerPoint presentation that maybe most school districts don't always bring out. Explain, as far as Lake Ridge New Tech Schools is concerned, about the importance of the school district and the operations being an anchor for that area's economic development.
You are absolutely right. We employ many of our community members. Now, you understand in Lake Ridge, being a township school district, we don't have all of the businesses that most districts have. We are centered around a Walgreens, a Menards, and let me tell you, they help us in any way they can. Cornerstone Pizza, you know, mm-hmm. little mom-pop establishments, and we appreciate their business, but you can only ask them for so much. And so when we talk about the BPs of the world or the Standard Oils or the U.S. Steels and Middle Steels, we need those kind of dollars to support us. We have an educational foundation, but it's just the little local people that are able to contribute, that have been contributing to that. So when I ask and think about our community, we employ quite a few of our members. Now, let me just say, when we qualify the people in our communities to work, they still have to go through the background checks. They have to. You can't just assume you're going to get a job at Lake Ridge, because we look for the brightest and the best. They have to be qualified. They have to pass background checks. And they have to do all of the things that anybody else is coming into the district. But whenever we're able to employ our community members, that's a bonus for us. And we try to do that. What we're trying to do with this referendum, our property values will suffer. Good schools, people come. They want to live in the community. Bad schools, they are going to disappear. This year alone, I have to tell people, and you know, they think that transfer tuition students harm us in some way. But let me be the first to tell you, this year alone, if we did not have the transfer tuition students, we would have a problem in trying to meet ends, make our budget.
Where are many of the students that are taking advantage of with their parents with the transfer opportunity? Where are they coming from and coming into Lake Ridge?
Believe it or not, all over. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's no one area. We're all struggling for students now. I can tell you some of my colleagues, I get very upset with them when I see buses from Westside coming into our district. That bothers me, as well as if our buses are going in to pick up their kids, but we don't allow that unless they're special needs students to go into other people's areas. Mm-hmm. The signs that they'll put them right in our door about transfer tuition students, you know, we have a standard here. I tell my people, I don't care what other school district, if they are doing something that I feel we're not going to just jump in the mud and do the same thing. So we're not soliciting other people's students. We welcome anybody that wants to come. We run them through the process. But it is a hard pill today because we are all groveling for the same dollars, for the same students, and we all want what's best for our kids. Nobody, none of my colleagues are saying that they're doing something better than me, that they can produce a better student than I can. They're looking students equal dollars.
Well, Dr. Johnson Shirley, thank you for your frankness. And thank you for your outspokenness, to be sure. This is the time that I know that every superintendent that goes before their patrons asking for help at a referenda vote have different ways to approach it, because they know that that you have to sell the customer. And the customer in this case is not only a member of the school district with youngsters in the school district or maybe even employees, but you're also talking, too, about rather hard-bitten homeowners who claim that they pay enough in taxes. Why should I pay more? When you have to convince them that there's a very important reason why, and I know that's what you're doing in the Lake Ridge New Tech schools. And we thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it, and I hope we can follow through on this in more detail as well. If you have community meetings coming up, we'd like to mention that as well, too, in the future. Some of the residents there in Calumet Township who are part of the Lake Ridge School District will have a chance to attend these meetings coming up, and we thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Okay, and just to say, our next meeting is October 8th at 3 p.m. in our conference center. We changed the time for people that some work and for those that do not work, so we vary in times to try to meet everybody. And the last thing I'd like to say, come out and vote. That's going to make the difference. Let your voices be heard.
That's Dr. Sharon Johnson Shirley. She's the superintendent of the Lake Ridge New Tech Schools, and they have the two-question referenda listed at the top of the page for the November 6th general election. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Ronnie Martinez. He's Auto Gas Fleet Development Specialist for ICOM North America. Ronnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Carl.
You're welcome. Tell our listeners, what is ICOM North America and what do you do, Ronnie?
So ICOM North America is the manufacturer of propane liquid injection systems. Brought the technology over to the U.S. in 2004, and today we have over 30,000 vehicles on the road that run with our technology, alongside also other products and also natural gas systems for diesel vehicles.
So I think many people think of propane as nothing more than a fuel for their grill and don't realize it can be used as a vehicle fuel. So what types of fleets can benefit from propane auto gas, Ronnie?
Oh, many. When you look at it and really analyze the numbers, propane auto gas really makes sense for your Class 2 to Class 7 trucks or work vehicles, fleet vehicles. This is where it's based right now. It's fleet-based.
And so you're seeing a lot of the back-to-base types of vehicles being, potentially just retrofitted to run on propane?
Yes. Centralized fueling is always a plus. If they're coming back to home base, it's definitely a plus.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think are some of the environmental benefits of propane when compared to diesel?
Well, we can start with, the black soot that comes out of the exhaust pipe of a diesel truck no longer has that. When you look at a propane-powered vehicle, your particulate matter is down to almost zero. Your emissions are over 60% reduced. So as far as comparison of emissions, it's a complete different animal.
I see. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Today our guest is Mr. Ronnie Martinez, Auto Gas Fleet Development Specialist for ICOM North America. Ronnie, so I know propane does provide an economical advantage over diesel. Why don't you tell our listeners a little more about that also?
So really it starts with the cost of the application. So you look at a work truck, let's just say a Ford F-450 diesel truck, mm-hmm. compare that to a propane powered F-450 truck. You you don't have the DPF filters anymore. You don't have your diesel injector, diesel pump that you plan to replace, and they're very expensive to replace. You don't have all the after treatment that they've added to all the diesel engines. When you look at a propane power engine, you're really looking at a gasoline, very simple engine. So a lot of mechanics that are out there, driving themselves crazy trying to work on these diesel engines. When you look at a propane engine, they look at it and they're like, oh my God, it's so easy. It's just a gas engine.
Yes, and that's a lot what we're hearing. Yes.
Oh, yeah. So as far as cost goes, it's very much cheaper to maintain, much cheaper to operate on the road.
I see. So I know ICOM North America is very proud of its EPA certifications. And can you tell our listeners why being certified by the EPA is so important?
So you're held to high standards as far as the emissions go. So, just like your OEMs go through to get these vehicles to be legal to be driven on the road, we're held accountable the same way. And if a company goes to the extent of going to an EPA certification process, they're going to go to the extent of making sure that their safety compliance are there for, like, when you look at propane, it's NFPA 58. When you look at natural gas, NFPA 52. So if they're going through the EPA certification process, they're going to go through, the safety and everything else that comes along with it.
I see. So we're seeing a lot of school buses moving towards propane. And I know that ICOM is an international organization. I know you work all over the world. And I know you've been working a lot in Puerto Rico. Can you tell our listeners a little bit why it's so important in Puerto Rico with, they were devastated by the hurricane there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I experienced it firsthand. I went out there and visited, and a lot of stuff was still down as far as power goes. They use a lot of propane to power a lot of the buildings, a lot of the vehicles there. So your first responder, second responder vehicles, they were out of fuel before the storm even hit.
Mm-hmm.
They were impacted heavily when it came to the storm. And really, when it comes to propane, you can transport it very easily with, what they call a bobtail, which is a fuel transport truck. You can have full access to propane when it comes to national disasters. You saw it in Florida, we saw it in Texas. Propane was accessible at all times.
Mm-hmm. So I know if you had one thing to say to a business owner that owns a lot of different types of trucks, how would working with ICOM be an advantage for them?
Well, first we like to sit down and actually analyze what their cost of operation is currently, whether it's gasoline or diesel. And then look at what is the best option for them, whether it's, natural gas, whether it's propane. When you look at class 2 to class 7 vehicles, majority of times, 9 times out of 10 for us, we see that propane is the better choice. And so looking at their cost of operation, then come in and help them apply this fuel into their fleet operations so we don't disrupt what they got going on. It's not an easy transition, but if you walk it through and help everyone understand that this is just another fuel, just like they run gasoline or diesel,
mm-hmm.
you can make the transition fairly quickly, fairly easy.
And so how can people learn more about ICOM North America?
So, a couple of different ways. Our website is www.ICOM, I-C-O-M as in Mary, NorthAmerica.com, all spelled out, all one word, or on Facebook, ICOM North America.
And as we come to the end of our program here, Ronnie, any closing thoughts?
Drive green, save green.
Oh, wonderful. And again, we love the work that ICOM is doing, not only here in Indiana, but across the United States. And we look forward to future success with ICOM North America. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Ronnie Martinez, Autogas Fleet Development Specialist for ICOM North America. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio here on Regionally Speaking on Wednesdays. And you can also catch the podcast of Green Fleet Radio on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in what has been happening here with getting ready for the November election. And for that, we turn to the lady with state government who is responsible for keeping an eye on the election process. Secretary of State Connie Lawson is en route right now for a meeting, having left Valparaiso to head elsewhere for other meetings here. And Connie, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you, Chris, for asking me. It's a pleasure.
And I know that you have just finished up a recent candidate school that was held in Valparaiso today. Will you please explain what the candidate school concept is all about? And it's been around for a while, so it's not a new thing, I know.
That's right. Every election cycle, we reach out to candidates who need some education on the campaign finance forms that they need to file. What are the deadlines? What information needs to be there? What are the disclaimers and that need to be on campaign materials like yard signs and letterhead and those types of things? Conflicts of interest. What denotes a conflict of interest? And this year we added a new topic on cybersecurity and how to protect your campaign. So it's been a good swing. We started last week in Terre Haute. We were in Evansville and Jeffersonville. We've been in Fort Wayne, Elkhart this morning, Valparaiso. Mm-hmm. We'll be in Lafayette this afternoon. And then this week we'll finish up in Indianapolis and we'll do a webinar on September 27th at 1 o'clock.
Now, how long have the idea of having a candidate school been underway? Is this something that you established since becoming Secretary of State, or has this been going on by your predecessors?
No, I believe we established it. We did the first ones in 2014. We've done them in 16 and now in 18. And so they've been very popular. Candidates really want to do things right. I mean, this is a nonpartisan issue, right? And so they don't want to get caught and have a bad public perception because they didn't know how to fill out a campaign finance report or they filed it late. So this is just to help them understand the process, and I think they've really enjoyed it.
I would imagine, too, that being up to date on campaign finance issues and other things that they need to know as a candidate, as well as what you pass on to your campaign staff, is just common sense.
That's right. You know, every campaign committee has obviously the candidate, but they have a chair and a treasurer as well. The candidates actually can serve as their own chair and treasurer. But I always tell them that if you are, you better be in a very small campaign, because this is the time of year when you need to be busy out on the road and knocking on doors. And the last thing you need to worry about is paperwork.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this time around you've added on the extra component of the cybersecurity issue. Tell us what prompted you to, well, it was time to set up the campaign school for this year. What prompted you to go that route to be able to include cybersecurity as one of the points that you bring up?
Sure. Well, we've focused on security for elections since 2016, really even before then, but it became a main focus for the office since that time. And we've learned that, you know, not only did the Democrat National Committee have issues in 2016, but since that time, other campaigns have been attacked. Microsoft just found out this year that there were some nefarious campaign sites candidates didn't even know they were there. So this is a message. They need to be vigilant on their cyber hygiene. Two of the most important things that they can do is, number one, I remember that, you know, their iPhone, their iPad, their laptop, they should not have the same passwords on those devices, and they should have strong passwords that can contain upper and lower case, numbers, symbols, those kinds of things. And so that's, you know, one of our messages. And then the other message is two-factor authentication, we've also learned, is a very important action that they should take. So if they have a Microsoft or a Google platform, they can set the setting where that they not only need a username and password, but they'll receive a text or an email with an additional maybe 6-digit number that they have to insert to have access to their website and social media. So this is really important. It's a great way to protect their campaign sites. And we tell them as well, you know, if you have a campaign site on Facebook, you also should be looking on Twitter, Instagram, and other social media sites for your campaign to make sure somebody hasn't put a fake campaign site up there.
Mm-hmm. I know you have a chance, obviously, to take questions and offer answers when you get together for the candidate schools. In the other candidate schools that you've conducted around the state, including Valparaiso, have you had comments or questions in particular, or comments in particular from when you bring up a topic like cybersecurity, from the candidates themselves? Have they offered any, I guess, anecdotal information that they may have run into, and will you help work that out?
No, Chris, I can't recall any anecdotal information, but I will tell you that a lot of them understand the risk now after being presented, and they're taking notes, and they realize that it's human error. That is the easiest way for someone to get access to their accounts, and so we've given them a training site. It's at ittraining@sos.in.gov. where they can go and find out, you know, how to recognize, for an example, a phishing email that might be posed to them with the intent to put malware on their system. So they've been very attentive, and I think they've been very appreciative. You know, for the rest of the campaign school, really it's more about detail, paying attention to a detail, and I think they've appreciated that message as well.
We're talking with Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson. She's just finished up one of her candidate schools in Valparaiso this morning, and she's on the road now as we speak, headed to another one that's set up in Lafayette today. One of the other things I know that you have stressed, and this has come up before, when questions have come up about how secure our elections are going to be, you have and your staff members there have worked very hard to make sure that there won't be any problems for Hoosier voters to go to the polls this year.
That's right, Chris. We've been working with the Federal Department of Homeland Security. They've been doing cyber hygiene testing on our system every 2 weeks. We have also had them do a RVA, a risk and vulnerability assessment, and we've taken their recommendations and instituted some new measures to harden our system. I think it's important for people to remember that our voting systems are not connected to the internet. They're not connected to one another. And every voting machine that's used in the state of Indiana has a paper trail. Not all of them have a voter verifiable paper trail, but we're moving in that direction. So I think that it's important for them to understand that we're doing everything we can. We're following the best practices.
Now that brings us up to the question of voter registration. We know that, in fact, yesterday was the official National Voter Registration Day, and we recall that. And, of course, as we get ready for the November 6th election, Hoosiers that want to vote in the election for the races that are up there, and including such mundane things as school district referenda, which are on the ballot in a lot of places, including here in Lake County. We know that October 9th is the deadline to register to vote. It just shows how important it is to be sure that you're in the system so that you know that you can walk into your neighborhood polling place where you're supposed to go and be able to cast your ballot, is it not?
That's correct, Chris. And I would just recommend that every voter go into IndianaVoters.com. Even if you think you're registered, go in and just check your registration before October 9th. Make sure you're there and the information is correct. I think it's, you know, very important. At IndianaVoters.com, you can register to vote. You can apply for an absentee ballot. You can find out who's on your ballot. You can find out where you need to go vote. And if you're checking on your mobile device, you can even get the directions to the polling location. So, you know, we want everyone to be registered and to participate in our election on November the 6th. Obviously, voting is your voice in government from every level, from the local to the national level.
Well, Connie, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the importance of certainly of voter registration here in Indiana, since we have only until now October 9th to be able to register to vote if you haven't done so already. And I'm glad to hear that so many people who are candidates for public office take advantage of the candidate school to pick up some pointers, to be able to be better candidates, even though maybe they don't feel that maybe as a candidate that you don't need to know some things, but you'd be surprised the things that you have to know, the background things that you have to know, like campaign finance information, and even down to cybersecurity that you have to be aware of when you're running for public office, to be sure. Thank you very much for being with us, Connie, and explaining these things to us. And we hope that many more people who are running for public office if they haven't already signed up for Canada School, wherever there's one in their particular area that hasn't yet to come up. And I know, as you mentioned, there have been a lot so far in Indiana, including the one that you're headed to now in Lafayette. So hopefully there are more to come between now and the time that the series runs out, the candidates have a chance to get in there and learn what they need to know.
And we just might remind everybody that there is a webinar at 1 o'clock on September the 27th if they can't attend one of our local events.
That's great.
And so thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad that you had a chance to chat while you're on the road to headed to the next candidate school in Lafayette, and we appreciate you taking time today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That's Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson.
A bill passed during the 2018 legislative session requires public high schools in Indiana to offer a computer science elective starting in 2021. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg tells us, smaller school districts in the state could find compliance a bit more challenging.
Kevin Smith has been on the job as Covington School Corporation superintendent for 45 days. His desk is covered in neat stacks of paper, notebooks, and binders. And a school walkie-talkie.
I don't like it this way, but it is what it is for today.
Covington sits near the Illinois border in Fountain County. It's the county seat, with a population of about 2,500. Smith was previously a principal in towns such as downstate Switt City, so he's used to education in less populated places. But for small towns with limited resources, it can be a big challenge to implement the state's new computer science requirements.
The long and short of it is, look, to say that it's not a challenge to be able to meet the needs of everyone, it is. Well, to me, that's going to be true whether it's a larger school or a smaller school.
At the high school level, Covington currently offers classes in web design and in what it calls digital responsibility, essentially a computer catch-all. To comply with the new legislation, the corporation's schools have to offer at least one of the courses on a list provided by the state, which range from Intro to Computer Science to AP Computer Science Principles. The state won't mandate how many students take those classes, just that they're available. But finding instructors may be the first challenge.
I'm the only technology teacher at our high school.
Craig Sauer's desk faces a classroom lined with 24 computers.
Each kid has a one-on-one device. They all have Chromebooks, so there's no shortness of technology. There's just a shortness of space, and there's a shortness of me is what becomes the problem.
So what's a small school corporation like Covington to do if it needs more teachers trained in CS? Hiring additional full-time staff is not in the budget for many districts. The Senate bill does offer some professional development funding for teachers to learn computer science. But that could mean making an art or a home ec teacher a part-time CS instructor, and thus having them teach fewer classes in their specialty. Karen Jung is the president of NextTech, an Indianapolis nonprofit instructing teachers across the state on how to implement computer science in K-12 classrooms. She says teachers who don't have a technology background can feel intimidated.
I think one of the historical challenges, and it's not specific to just Indiana, but is helping folks to understand what computer science is and is not, and why every student should have access to it.
Jung says many people see computer science simply as coding, programming, or software development. But there's a bigger picture.
Computer science is all about the fundamentals of problem solving, creativity, creating algorithms, how to solve problems that really transcend any specific programming language or any specific type of technology. And really any subject, and prepare a student for success post-secondary, regardless of what career path they go down.
In 2017, 115 of Indiana's 525 high schools, that's just more than one-fifth, offered computer science courses. That number will need to more than quadruple by the 2021 deadline. In a conference call, Indiana Department of Education spokesman Adam Baker says the DOE understands the challenges school districts will face, especially ones like Covington, where funds might be limited.
I mean, that's one of the things that we, you know, don't take lightly, but one of the things we enjoy is working with districts to kind of figure out those solutions.
Back in the Covington superintendent's office, Kevin Smith is realistic. 45 days into his job, he doesn't know the answer, but he's confident there will be a plan by the deadline.
We may not see what it's going to be sitting here today, but we'll get the right answer at the right time.
Covington has the next two school years to find a solution. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
There is an organization here in Northwest Indiana called Hannah's Hope, and we'll find out more about it from the family members who helped create the program. It's the idea of Michael and Mary Martinez here in Northwest Indiana, and Michael is with us to talk about Hannah and about Hannah's Hope. Thanks for being with us today.
Chris, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about Hannah Martinez, the young lady who sadly is not with us any longer, but she seems to live on in the form of the nonprofit organization.
Correct. Hannah was, and it still is, my middle daughter. She was born with a prenatal stroke, is what we were eventually told the diagnosis was, and you know, with that suffered many challenges along the way developmentally. Mm-hmm. And what my wife and I did was, shortly after finding out her diagnosis, we had an idea to host a golf outing. And what we did with that golf outing was to raise some money for other kids with special needs, and got involved in the First Steps program, which helped Hannah with therapies and her development aspect of life. And we ended up having a golf outing 8 years ago, and we've spawned into this little organization here that is now Hannah's Hope, which we thought would be just a small little endeavor, and it's turned into this big thing. But Hannah was, she was an inspiration. I've told people 1,000 times, she never spoke a word, never took a step, and she did more with her 3 years on this earth than most people do in a lifetime.
One of the things that you note when you go to the website and take a look at the mission statement to learn more about Hannah's Hope is that it's an organization that provides developmental equipment to kids with special needs, as well as connecting families by making life and communities more accessible. And one of the things that's interesting, too, which kind of gets us to the latest event here, is the grand opening of what is called Hannah's Hope Playground. Tell us where it's located and describe it. I understand it's a very, very unique playground.
It is. It is the brainchild of 7 years of sitting, looking at magazines, trying to pick out unique equipment so that all kids can play regardless of ability. It again started as an idea while sitting at a park out in Schererville, where my wife and I were there with my oldest daughter at the time, and only one of the two children could play. There was no equipment for Hannah to use. Mm-hmm. And what we did is, we teamed up with Game Time, which is a playground equipment manufacturer, in Sinclair Recreation out of Michigan. And we've opened a playground right in downtown Portage at Founders Square, right behind the new fire station. It's a 17,000 square foot playground with some very unique equipment. It is going to be recognized as a national demonstration site for playground in terms of inclusivity. And what we did is, about a week and a half ago, we opened up that playground with a ribbon cutting, and we had probably 300 people there, parents and kids alike, which we're able to now reconnect families to play as one cohesive unit if you did have a child with special needs.
Now, we usually think of a playground having the typical slides and swings and things like that, and maybe a teeter-totter, you know, within the new version of that. What is so unique about what's been set up in this particular playground? Because I know that you've designed it on purpose to make sure that youngsters with developmental issues can learn as well as grow and hopefully get stronger.
Correct. We still have the slides. We still have swings. We still have the teeter-totters. We still have all those things that you would find at a normal playground. We did not want to have this playground known as, you know, quote-unquote, the handicapped playground. We wanted this to be a playground for all. But some of the equipment that we have a roller table. So if a child is in a wheelchair, they can put themselves on this table and kind of pull themselves through this little tunnel on these roller bars. The seesaw that we have is not your typical two-person seesaw. It is a seesaw made for four or five people. There are two seats on each side with a small disc in the middle where if a child is unable to sit up, they can lay down on the disc. We have six or seven different types of swings. And on many of the pieces of equipment that you go there, we have a small sticker that Hannah's Hope put up there with a QR code that a parent or a therapist can scan that QR code, and it takes to a website, which gives
ideas on how to utilize that equipment for developmental purposes.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. What kind of a reaction have you gotten since the grand opening to this very unique and all the features on this playground?
We've yet to hear a bad word about it. We've had nothing but great feedback. A lot of what Hannah's Hope has done in the past is, like you had mentioned earlier, Chris, was we purchased equipment for kids. Mm-hmm. So if you attended a Hannah's Hope event and you donated money to our golf outing or a bowling tournament or a craft fair or something of that nature, you know, that money was put to good use. We don't have any paid employees. We're all volunteers. And that money was to help a kid somewhere down the line, you know, reach their fullest potential. But, you know, our supporters don't always get to see that. So to have this playground be a very tangible item that everyone can wrap their head around and go grab with their hands and say, you know what, I went to a Hannah's Hope event, I was a part of this, and we tell everyone, this is your playground as much as it is ours.
Now, I know that you and your wife, Mary, have devoted so much time and energy into this project in particular, the playground in particular, but obviously everything else that is offered by the Hannah's Hope organization. Any other things that you all have in mind or are in the works right now that you're hoping to be able to unveil in the future?
Well, there's still going to be, we had a lot of questions, that exact question. What is the next project for Hannah's Hope?
Right.
We are going to continue on a daily basis to help kids throughout Northwest Indiana reach their fullest potential, either through equipment, utilizing the playground. We're going to continue those missions that we do. But also, there's also going to be a phase two to the playground. We're going to need some seating. We're going to need some more shade. There's also going to be an entryway sign that we're going to put up. So, we've told people a thousand times that we've been talking about this playground for so long. This is not the end of Hannah's Hope. This is just the beginning. I really think this playground now being so tangible for Northwest Indiana is going to really be a jumpstarter for us.
Now, do you think that there are other projects that Hannah's Hope is going to be able to work with in conjunction with working with the city of Portage, in addition to the expansion that you want to see on the playground?
We've never ruled anything out. Anytime anyone would like to come with us with an idea, if it fits our mission and we can help, we're gonna do our best to do so. I can't say for certain, but I mean, who knows? There may be another playground in another city somewhere along the line.
Michael Martinez, thank you very much for spending time talking with us about Hannah and about Hannah's Hope. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure.
Michael Martinez, who along with his wife Mary have created Hannah's Hope. It's a nonprofit charity that was started in honor of Hannah Martinez, who passed away at the age of 3. She had been born with severe brain damage caused by a prenatal stroke, but her memory is living on in the hopes of helping other young people that have developmental problems and their families be able to cope with these things and learn and grow from this. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us now in the studio to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney.
Dear Ollie, I heard your show on Lakeshore Radio August 1st, and I felt so badly for Buster, that little Mexican chihuahua who was worried about being sent to Mexico, especially when he had never lived there. You answered in such a caring manner. Luckily, Victoria was there to translate your words so we could understand what you really meant. Our son Sam translates techie talk into talk real people can understand. So I get it. It's quite an art. I have a friend with a Chihuahua dog named Maria. She is loyal, alert, intelligent, graceful, and charming. And her woman-human loves her because she is tiny and fits nicely into her purse to keep her company wherever she goes. But like Buster, she's worried about a breed-specific ban or deportation. Dog lovers know that the diversity of dogs is so valuable. The many breeds, sizes, and colors they come in, their different countries of origin and their behaviors, that enriches our lives. What if she were swept up, so to speak, especially if she's been a good dog and a good companion and never really did anything wrong? Signed, Bobby Galler, Union Township.
Dear Bobby, Buster the Chihuahua is still upset about all of this immigration stuff. There are still children in detention centers run by our government, and their parents are scattered to the four corners. I fear for the children behind wire barricades, or what we call crates or cages in the animal shelter community. In the world of dog, a puppy must stay with its mother until 9 weeks old to learn how to get along in their world. I have heard that human children must be with a caring parent until 6 or 8 years old to obtain the maximum development, or, simply put, to learn how to get along in the human world. Reports like the recording from ProPublica, which obtained children crying for their parents, or accounts of children in temporary foster care crying themselves to sleep every night, inspire in a lot of people the idea that something deeply wrong is happening. They make it apparent that not only are children being harmed, but they may be harmed permanently. It seems to be, in a word, traumatic. But when we call family separation traumatic, what does that actually mean? Over the past few decades, we've gained a lot of insight into this question, and one of the foremost experts on it is Nadine Burke Harris, an American pediatrician whose organization, the Center for Youth Wellness, does research and clinical work on adverse childhood experiences that may increase the likelihood for risky health behaviors, chronic health conditions, low life potential, toxic stress, or an early death. The key to preventing an adverse childhood experience from metastasizing into toxic stress, Harris and others have concluded, is having a safe, stable, nurturing relationship with an adult caregiver during an early childhood. I wonder what the long-term effect will be for children of immigrants to America still separated from their parents. I know firsthand what the effect is of a puppy being separated from its mother too soon. Sickness, death, or the inability to adapt to life as a well-behaved dog in a human family. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie. And remember, love is a four-legged word.
If you have a question for Ollie, your friend in fur, you can email it to Ollie at lakeshorepublicmedia.org is the email address to Ask Ollie. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. On Saturday, September 29th and Sunday, September 30th, the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana is hosting its 6th annual Giant Yard Sale. It'll be in the Family Arts and Crafts Building at the Lake County Fairgrounds in Crown Point from 8 a.m. until 3 p.m. on both Saturday the 29th and Sunday the 30th. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow's Thursday, which means we have Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll talk to reporters about the stories that they have offered up in print and online. And Dan Carden with the Times of Northwest Indiana, who covers news out of the Statehouse, will be with us.